Good morning, all. This is your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the September 17, 2013 edition of Ask a Leader. Yesterday, I want to wish all Mexicanos, Mexicanas, a happy Independence Day. That's the real day. That's not the St. Patrick's Cinco de Mayo day for Mexican independence. Yesterday was the day for starting with that El Grito outside the huge plaza in Mexico City. So many years ago, I'd like to remember what number that is. Today, we're going to have author, blogger David Nywert to talk about his latest book, And Hell Followed With Her. It's a bit of a seg from what Heather and Robert were just talking about. His book deals with the vigilante movement alive and quite well along our southern border. And then we'll have on UCI neurobiology professor Dr. David Cribbs. We'll talk about his neuroscience, some of which will be presented at the 24th Annual Alzheimer's Conference to be held this Friday in Costa Mesa. Don't go away. We'll be right back after a brief interlude. Welcome back to the show. Many of you have seen the recent cartoon situation in a rural border. I think it's a cartoon from Cucaracha. It's in a rural border town. It depicts two residents overlooking a hyper-militarized border security measures in action, and with the said couple ruining the quieter days when only a few undocumented workers were making their way through the land. Taking up this hyper-militarized status quo is my first guest today, David Nywert, author of And Hell Followed With Her, published this year, just recently published by Nation Books. David Nywert, raised in Idaho, earned his BA in English at the University of Idaho and studied creative writing at the University of Montana. He worked at newspapers around the Pacific Northwest from 78 to 1996. He went to work at MSNBC.com in 1996 as a writer-producer and continued there through late 2000, where he received the National Press Club Award for Distinguished Online Journalism in 2000 for a domestic terrorism series he produced there. Since then, he's focused on writing books and producing his blog, Orcinus?
Orcinus,
covering the crossover between the mainstream and the far right. The Northwest Progressive Institute named its annual awards region's best liberal bloggers after Nywert. He also writes for the political blog Crooks and Liars. He comes to us today from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to the show, David Nywert.
Thank you so much for having me, Claudia.
Well, I tell you, David, this book informed while creeping me out. What kind of reception is your book getting?
Well, you know, people who actually take the time to read it are enthralled and engrossed by it. It's an amazing story. It is, unfortunately, you know, kind of an unpleasant and it's a story we, you know, it's confronting of some of our darker side of the American psyche. And so I think to some extent, people have shied away from it. I certainly have had trouble getting it reviewed, but
really,
people who actually read it think very highly of it. And when it's been reviewed, I've gotten very good reviews. So, I think part of it is too that it's hard to get media attention for a book like this because it's very critical of the mainstream media.
We'll get to that. We're going to open that all the way up, and that's as a summary reference because the media was one of the main characters in your book, I must say. But that we'll save for just a moment. But about your reactions, that some people are maybe a little defensive because of your calling it like it is in how the dynamics played out.
Yeah, I think that we have gotten to this stage in the discussion and the debate about immigration where we kind of forget where a lot of this talk came from. And people don't understand that when we're talking now about securing the border and border security, that this stuff all originated with these Minutemen down there. People need to understand that what this kind of talk does is it casts the whole debate about immigration into a life where we're almost fetishized about the supposed criminality of these people coming over the border, who are, in fact, more or less victims themselves of a seriously messed up system, which is what immigration reform should be about, is reforming that system so we're not criminalizing otherwise hardworking, law-abiding people, which is what the system does.
Well, I think, David, no, needn't pull punches about fetishizing. I think it's full-on fetishizing with how paranoid and how vividly the vigilante movement has depicted non-Aryan kinds of intrusions into what they see as a pure Caucasian American cultural societal arrangement. So it's, I think it's really, you get to call it fetish straight on. So what, and so we're asking about your the reactions to tell all any of the characters that you've been in contact with after the publication of the book. That what were their reactions? Did you get?
If you're talking about Minutemen, the only reaction we've gotten so far didn't come to me directly. It came from Jim Gilchrist,
okay,
the man who empowered Shawna Ford. And he was asked about the findings, my investigative findings, by a reporter from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And he went on a rampage with this poor reporter for several days, called her up constantly and you know, was telling this person what a horrible reporter I was and how I was lying and so on and so forth. And, in fact, he also wrote into Alternet after we published these findings there and denounced me as a liar, but didn't actually specify anything that I'd gotten wrong, which is pretty typical for Jim.
A taste of that.
And he's made a lot of noises about threatening me, but I've certainly not heard anything personally from Jim Gilchrist or his people there in California. You know, all I can say is, I mean, part of the problem is he knows that we would welcome a lawsuit because we'd love to go through the process of discovery on this with Jim's own records. And moreover, he also knows that we have the records. I mean, I have all of Shawna Ford's phone records and her emails, and it lays out very clearly that she was in constant contact with Jim Gilchrist.
And so, I just wanted to clarify for you, my guest here, that David, that this microphone is smack in the middle of the 48th Congressional District, where it was under a different number. I think we were 45 at that point, we're 45 now. We were the 48th Congressional District where Jim Gilchrist ran when there was an open seat in 2005 in a special election. So we're still sort of quaking in our boots about his political contributions, and he's still around, as you say. So,
sure.
And much of the vigilante fanfare would not be for all the important role that the media played in giving attention and therefore much oxygen, as you were referring to earlier, to the Minutemen movement. You make that so clear. Some media played more of a role than others, as you point out in the book.
Well, certainly CNN and Lou Dobbs played a dominant role in promoting these characters initially. It was a number of CNN reports, and it wasn't just Dobbs who was promoting them. They had a reporter named Casey Wyan who avidly reported on these border watches that Chris Simcox began organizing really back in about 2003 is when Simcox began doing this, and late 2002. And he called it the Tombstone Militia, which caught my eye back then. In fact, my very first post in January of 2003 at my blog Orsinus was about Chris Simcox, because these guys caught my attention, partly because I've been monitoring the extremist right for many, many years.
Yes.
Being out of Idaho, I got inured in that whole culture when we had the Aryan Nations folks up here. And so we were aware that the far right was planning to use the immigration issue as their chief recruiting tool from about like late 1998 on forward. We could see that this is where they were going. And, of course, the militia movement was one of their main efforts at mainstreaming themselves. And so this was something that we were watching very closely, and I was monitoring very closely the whole issue of, are we going to start seeing border militias? And so when Chris Simcox started up his Tombstone Militia back there in late 2002, it very much caught my attention. And sure enough, CNN comes along, starts promoting these guys as you know, like straightforward citizens, instead of explaining that this is actually part of the militia movement, you know?
Right, right.
Was a problem right away. And then, of course, once Dobbs got the ball rolling, then Fox News was all over it, you know, and very closely. And Sean Hannity probably promoted it even more avidly than Lou Dobbs did, especially during the big April 2005 event when they launched the Minutemen Project as a national campaign to do this border watch. Instead of, you know, the idea of the Minutemen Project was to expand it from beyond these little border militia cells and make it a national thing where we had people going down and sitting on the border. And, of course, the whole scene in Arizona in 2005 was fabricated for the media. They
right.
put these people down there on the border in Naco in an area where there was not going to be any kind of actual human trafficking. I mean, they didn't put them in a human smuggling corridor. They put them in a place where they could get great photo ops of people sitting out watching the border and have the TV crews and the camera and the photographers come along and take lots of pictures. And in fact, there were really only, you know, they promised about 1,000 people or something like that would show up, and really only about 100 and between 150 and 200
right.
actually signed up. And we had over 250, between 250 and 300 media people there. So the media actually outnumbered the border watchers there. But if you go back and watch that coverage from April 2005, you would never have known that from any of the reporters who were actually there.
I would go to that, but I'm afraid the NSA is going to monitor that and put me in a profile I'm not interested in being. But it was enough that the ones that I tracked down. But at the end, like, I'm going to say not good sociopaths, but like classic sociopaths that many of the adherents to the Minuteman movement, they knew how to play the media. They had their microphone on pitch, and then they had their microphone off engagement with each other, and they were not the same. They pulled no punches when they were together planning, but the media never saw that. But those like you, digging deeply, you definitely found that. Well, for those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Ask a Leader on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, streaming live and all grassroots movements, home sets around the world on KUCI.org, where my guest is author David Neiwirth, talking about what his latest book, And Hell Followed With Her, is monitoring in the way of the burgeoning vigilante movement. Well, I'd like to have you. I'm not going to give any spoiler alerts. I want for people to have a chance to get into the nitty gritty of all your research with these people in their own words and their sort of moment to moment kinds of organizing, moment to moment actual assaults and. So I won't go into that, but I would like to explore a bit about the trajectory of immigration policy, the lessons that we should be learning based on the research that you did for this book.
Well, really above it all, I think what I would say this book is a plea for people to stop and think about how we talk about immigration. When we talk about immigration as a matter of, you know, well, do we give amnesty to these people who've broken the laws? What kind of laws are these people broken? Are they felons or are they, you know, and are they bringing crime over the border? Are they costing taxpayers millions? When we make it all about the people who have been caught in this vice rather than the vice itself, then we're going to be demonizing a bunch of helpless, vulnerable people, and that's what we do. That's what people like the Minutemen and the nativists do. And nativism has been with us for many, many years. Since the 1840s, when the Irish, the anti-Irish gangs are roaming the streets of New York, this has been what they do. They demonize people, they attack the vulnerable, and they leave behind a legacy of misery and suffering and death. I mean, and this, of course, this book recounts the really horrible death of a little 9-year-old girl down there in the town of Aravaca.
Right.
At the hands of these Minutemen. And was the, you know, how can you, so in a lot of ways, I mean, a lot of why I felt compelled to write this book was for that little girl and for her mother, because I sat in the courtrooms. There were three trials in this case, and this mother who had her daughter killed while she laid there on the ground pretending to be dead,
right,
and listening to the whole thing. You know, she was there for every single day of every court proceeding that they had in these three trials, and she testified three times. And, you know, she's just the bravest woman I ever met. And I just felt compelled that this story had to be out. But at the same time, people needed to understand the underlying causes, that this was what happens when you go down this road of demonizing people and fomenting hate, that you become so desensitized to the reality that these are human beings that you lose your own humanity yourself. And certainly in the case of Shawna Ford, I think that it's very clear that that's what happened. That she would go down this road, but it's not just her. She was part and part of that whole milieu that was fomented by the Minutemen, which was really all about, like I say, they claimed that it was about the border and securing the border, but they didn't care about the border. They cared about brown people coming over. That was what they were on about.
Well, and
that's
also
what they were always on about.
And how to fine tune your alpha part of yourself to be more the leader than the next guy in a slew of people who wanted to be the leader in this movement.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, because they all had huge egos. And it's interesting to note, of course, that this movement began falling apart within the first month of its creation. Even 2 weeks after they began the Minutemen Project there in Arizona, Gilchrist and Simcox were feuding so badly they wouldn't even speak to each other. And it wasn't just them. And, of course, it was endemic throughout the movement because it attracted angry, bellicose, paranoid, fearful white men who had huge egos and serious antisocial sort of behavioral issues. And so they just began bickering and falling apart really within months or within weeks of even starting to come together.
And a lot of them had abuse issues from their earlier development. So they were a pretty maimed lot, as it were. Well, the Tea Party, giving haven to the Minutemen movement, it's better funded than the Minutemen ever were. Will it be, do you think, David, better disciplined than any of the vigilante flanks? Do you think it'll continue to be forced to be reckoned with and enable perhaps to perpetuate the vigilante groups that have joined rank with them?
Well, I think what the Tea Party movement has done more than anything is served as a cover for legitimizing a pretty broad spectrum of extremism, including border extremists. But it's actually attracted within its ranks and has within its ranks large number of people that we would have called militiamen, especially back in the 90s. And it's the same people, and these are people who are filling the ranks of the Tea Party and, in fact, leading them in many regards. I mean, some of these Tea Party or some of these Minutemen leaders, notably Glenn Spencer, who was really the godfather of the whole Minutemen movement, this former California right-wing activist who moved to Arizona back in 2002. Spencer was the guy who was fomenting for border militias back in the 1990s. And he was designated, his organization was designated a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center back in 1992 for its overt racism. And it always has been. But anyway, Spencer is now one of the leading Tea Party people down there in Arizona. He brings in Sheriff Joe Arpaio and Russell Pierce, these Arizona nativist figures, to help promote Tea Party events. And what it's really done is that it's actually helped broadcast that message to a really large number of people, a much larger audience, and they have a much larger following now,
yes,
than they used to have, these extremists.
Well,
so I think that there is that, and that's the chief problem with them. I do think that, like most right-wing extremist organizations, they will always have the problem of maintaining unity because they do attract a lot of people with personality disorders, mainly because of the nature of their appeals, which are, you know, functionally psychopathic appeals. They're totally devoid of empathy. They're totally, it's all about scapegoating other people. It's all about, there's a great degree of paranoia and fear and anger.
And narcissism.
All of this all rolled into one ugly little ball in this Border Watch movement. And what actually happens is that they come together and they'll get this message out to a large number of people, and then they'll break apart and they'll form these smaller, more discrete cells that are actually much more dangerous, much more radical, and much more prone to violence. I've kind of reported in this book that I felt that the Border Watch movement was dead, but I'm getting reports even now from my sources in Arizona that actually there's still a lot of Border Watch activity down there, but it's now all these little, very small cells of four or five people who like to go out on the border and shoot immigrants, you know?
Well, I think with the materiel that is becoming ever-present there with the let's say, let's a trifecta there. There's the federal enforcement under pressure in the immigration policy debate of arming further along the border. There are the drug cartels that have their own arms, and they're getting more and more sophisticated. And then the vigilante movement I imagine we should project that increasingly will become a bit more threatening with the availability of airborne kinds of surveilling and missile firing kind of capacity. I mean, we've got a lot hovering over that border like never imagined.
Yeah. Oh, it's actually incredible how militarized the border is already. If you go down there, the Border Patrol presence is just unmistakable. They're everywhere because they're pouring in all kinds of money and staffing the Border Patrol like crazy down there. Ironically, they are, some of that money has come over to the border up here in Washington State. And what the Border Patrol is doing up here was doing with that money for a while instead of actually beefing up security along the Canadian border, which I can tell you is very lightly secured.
Right.
There's hardly any real security up there. I mean, a lot of places, the Canadian border up here is just a ditch that you can hop across.
Right. But where is the money going that you were saying instead of that?
Well, they're putting it into staff, into ICE staff and Border Patrol. And so what they've actually been doing with the staff is that they've been out harassing Latino mushroom pickers in the woods out here.
Oh, my.
Instead of... So they got sued by the ACLU for doing that, and they had to stop.
Well, it's probably no laughing matter, because the kind of vitriol that you've researched about harassing people at the day worker places, at the other employment, it's something they've had a thought to fine-tune. Well, I know that Jan Brewer's embraced those that are coming in. I was backtracking a little bit. I want to make sure. So they've been given a lot of legitimacy in their working through the Tea Party. It's a bit daunting here. There was another thing I want to bring up. Have you had more contact with Steve Johnson with No More Deaths, the people that are trying to assist the people coming over the border from the perils that face them in the climate that they're over the border?
I haven't had any contact with Steve, but I have been in touch with several of the border organizers down there, and yeah, they're very concerned. They're saying that their water supplies are getting shot out by these militiamen, these border watchers that are operating in these small cells down there.
Where they leave jugs of water around.
Yeah, the people who go out and leave water for border crossers at water stations are having their water stations be destroyed by these militiamen. So, and of course, that's part of their philosophy. I had a lot of men tell me that they would, if they came across such water stations, that they would destroy the water or take it themselves. And, you know, because they believe that that's part of how you keep them from coming over. And at the bottom line, I mean, a few of them you'd even hear, we'd get quotes from some sources where, I mean, I've got one on tape where this guy says, yeah, if we just shoot one or two of them when they come over the border, that would stop them from coming over.
Well, you researched, there were many of them that said that. It's a kind of refrain, how to dissuade them. But it's, as you said, with NAFTA being a very structural kind of piece here to the depletion of cottage industries of local sustenance farming in Mexico, that there is a huge incentive still for people to keep crossing. And with undocumented children on one side of the border, the crossing is going to continue. It's really, it's an unwieldy saga going on.
So. Yeah, and it's all because we have a system that's really predicated in a xenophobic fear of outsiders. It was built back in 1924 with the 1924 Immigration Act, and that act was specifically about keeping out non-white invaders, as they were called, or aliens. And those people at the time were Asians, who were widely believed to, it was widely believed in 1924 that these people, these Asians, would never become real Americans. And so that's where the term illegal alien comes from, because they were kind of seeing these Asians as not being, you know, like fit for American society. And that's still that was the foundation of our immigration system, and it's still the bones on which it operates. And it's still, we still, even people who come through legally have to go through so many hoops and fight through so many bureaucratic hurdles that it's just an incredibly unwieldy system, because we seem to believe for some reason that we need to make it hard for people to become citizens.
Right.
And it just, there's no particular logic to that. We should either admit people as citizens because we value their skills and want them here, or or they've proven up as citizens. And it doesn't, you don't have to make it hard for them to be here. So that old system, this old xenophobic system, is what we run our immigration system on now. And I think the best example of it is the fact that, you know, we have an economy that creates about 500,000, about 500,000 unskilled labor jobs every year.
And only 5,000, as you said, green?
Yes. Right. We only issue 5,000 green cards to cover that.
So there's,
which is just insane.
Right.
And even now, our current immigration reform talk is, well, let's bring in these high tech workers. Let's go for the, you know, let's bring in these high skill workers instead of the low skill workers. Well, we don't need high skill workers. Those are the people. When we start bringing in H-1B visa people, those are the jobs. That's the immigration that actually does take jobs away from Americans. And instead, we need to be bringing in a lot more people with low skills who are willing to come in and do the work and want to become citizens.
Well, that David, that's a whole topic we could take up another time on the show. And I need to close now. And I thank you. For those of you that are interested in hearing more about this, David Neiwirth's blog is Crooks and Liars, and the book he's recently published is And Hell Followed With Her, Shawna Ford. I didn't really want to mention her name because she's gotten so much ink, so much press. I didn't want to dirty my microphone with such an individual. But that is all the time that we have. And David, I want to thank you for your thick skin research and writing this book, and of course being on the show today. Thank you so much.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on, Claudia.
Well, we're going to take it. This is part of what I was going to do here. We are going to take a break here after talking with David. And then we'll bring on another David, David Cribbs, who will be talking about his research at the 24th Annual Alzheimer's Conference. Don't go away. Well, next up we have on the show, we've got my next guest, Professor David Cribbs, who's going to be contributing his findings at this year's Alzheimer's Convention that we'll talk about in great detail later in Costa Mesa this Friday. hosted by the UCI Institute of Memory Impairments and Neurological Disorders, that's UCI Mind, and the Alzheimer's Association, the Orange County chapter. This conference convenes nationally and internationally recognized experts to address the progress our nation is making in the fight against Alzheimer's disease. The long-term goal of Professor David Cribb's research is to identify the critical age-related factors responsible for the initiation and the progression of Alzheimer's disease, or AD, we might be saying in shorthand later on. The title of his talk at the conference on Friday is, and I quote, "Progress in Immunotherapy for Treating Alzheimer's Disease." It's going to be in the research track, a new format for the conference that'll split up in the clinical and the research tracks for conferees to attend. Professor Cribbs received his PhD at West Virginia University in biochemistry. Previous to his 1992 appointment at UCI, he completed research at Johns Hopkins University. In 2008, Professor Cribbs received the Vander Noort Award for Outstanding Research in the Department of Neurology at UCI. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Professor Cribbs.
Thank you, Claudia.
Well, you are presenting your talk in the research track. Who, Professor Cribbs, will be your intended audience?
Well, it really will depend on who has an interest.
Okay.
Because people attending, there's healthcare professionals, physicians, care providers, family members, and researchers. So I'm hoping that the research track, because as you said in the introduction, it's the first time we've done this. There's also a clinical track where it'll be more on patient care and diagnosis, imaging, those types of topics. So I'm hoping that at least some of the audience will be interested in what's going on in the research track. And Matthew Blurton Jones is going to be talking on New Hope, Stem Cell Therapy in Alzheimer's Disease. And Dr. Charles Glabe is going to be talking about the role of amyloid in the development and treatment of Alzheimer's disease. So, and then I'm going to be talking about immunotherapy. So I think people will find it interesting. We're targeting it both for professionals as well as people without a science medical background. So I think it'll be interesting, and we'll see how it goes. Like you said, it's the first time we've had this research track. So.
And you will be around the entire day of the conference for interactions and actually, what is lovely in previous times that I've attended, I'll be attending again, for truth and disclosure there, that there is an interactive piece. People do try to create a red thread with throughout the talks, and it's great that you'll be there the whole day.
Yes, during the day, we encourage questions. Typically, the individual giving the presentation finishes the presentation, and then there's 5 or 10 minutes for questions from the audience. And I might add that it starts at 7 with registration and breakfast.
Yes.
Is breakfast and lunch are included in the program, the conference. And at the end of the day, there's a Ask the Doc forum. So all the speakers will be in on a panel on the stage, and so people have an additional chance to ask questions of the speakers. Typically, all the speakers are there at lunchtime as well. So there's an opportunity to move around, and everyone will have a name tag on. So it'll be easy to find the individual. And this is the 24th annual conference, so it's been a long time going, and it's generally well attended. We calculate or plan for about 500 people at the conference this Friday.
And there's space available. That information will be conveyed at the close here when I let you get on to your 10 o'clock meeting, and I'll cover all of that sort of thing.
It's still open for registration, and like you said, you'll provide that information at the end of the program.
So. Exactly. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about your own research that you're looking at. The work you're looking at the amino acid that it's called the amyloid beta, or amyloid beta, the peptide. It's an invariant feature in and Alzheimer's disease, and what do you mean by that, and what role does it play in the inflammatory factors that you're concerned about in the pathology of the brain affected that will contribute to Alzheimer's?
So most people that are familiar with Alzheimer's disease have heard of what are called senile plaques. The senile plaques in Alzheimer's disease are aggregates or aggregate is probably the best word.
Okay.
So these are dense deposits, aggregates of this beta amyloid peptide that you were talking about, and it's cleaved from a much larger protein called the amyloid precursor protein. And as you mentioned, it's an invariant feature. That is, if you can have dementia, but if you don't have senile plaques or amyloid plaque deposits, then you don't have Alzheimer's disease. And there's another. Pathological feature of Alzheimer's disease, the hyperphosphorylated tau. So those are the two features that are critical for the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. This amyloid peptide, you can think of it as sort of, I've heard some people refer to it as a cat hairball. These things accumulate in various areas in the brain, and the cells in the brain respond to the accumulation of this material. And really what we think is happening is it's not an overproduction of this peptide, but it's as we age, the ability to clear it from the brain decreases. And that's a significant part of my research and other researchers here at the University of California, Irvine, at the Institute for Memory Impairments and Neurological Disorders. So we want to understand why this peptide aggregates, and when it aggregates, how does it become toxic to the neurons? And as you mentioned in the introduction to this particular segment, we know that this peptide then activates inflammatory cells in the brain, and we think that that's a key component of the disease process. And I might add that Dr. Andrea Tenner is going to be talking about that in the morning session, inflammation as a therapeutic target in Alzheimer's disease, and she's an internationally known researcher in neuroinflammation, and so that'll be a wonderful presentation as well.
So as you mentioned about the various pathologies, are there then many holy grails to finding out the how to deal with Alzheimer's early on?
Yeah, there's several things that are exciting in Alzheimer's research these days, and one is the hunt for what we call biomarkers. It's quite possible that drugs have already been tried in clinical trials may have been valuable drugs, but they're tried so late in the disease process that there's little hope for actually having a therapeutic benefit, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
So by the time someone begins to show clinical signs based on people with genetic mutations that develop Alzheimer's disease, the pathology has been accumulating in the brain for 20 or 25 years. So this Alzheimer's pathology, these senile plaques and these aberrant tau accumulations in the brain in neurons have been accumulating for a long period of time, and so you have damage to the neurons that are critical for learning and memory and for many other functions, and you have neuroinflammation, chronic neuroinflammation going on for 10 or 20 years, and by imaging you can see that the brain is actually shrunk. That is, the brain, you have atrophy of the brain. The brain is basically wasting away. So by providing a drug that targets the amyloid peptide, this beta amyloid peptide, so late in the game, it's not likely that you'll have any therapeutic benefit. The reason we're excited about biomarkers, and these can be biochemical biomarkers or they can be imaging biomarkers. That is, so the biochemical biomarkers that are now being established and documented and confirmed are primarily found in the cerebral spinal fluid. So here at the Institute, and we also have an Alzheimer's Disease Research Center here. We're one of 27 around the country. So we have a clinical core that follows patients, both patients with dementia and non-demented individuals as well. And those that volunteer to give the CSF, we analyze biochemical markers in the CSF.
The cerebrospinal fluid.
Yep. Which provide, and other researchers as well, provide information about who is likely to develop Alzheimer's disease in the near future. That combined with the imaging technologies that are becoming available, where we didn't develop these compounds, but there are compounds now that you can inject into the blood, and they'll diffuse into the brain, and they'll bind to the pathology. And so then you're able to image the pathology in a living individual and see how much of this amyloid is accumulated in their brain. And we think it's going to be particularly valuable as we move forward with clinical trials, because you'll be able to see if your drug therapy is having an effect on the amyloid in the brain and also in these biomarkers that are in the cerebral spinal fluid. So we would expect improvement in the biomarkers in the cerebral spinal fluid, as well as a reduction in the amyloid or senile plaques in the brain in response to these therapies that are going to be tested.
So that's one of the holy grails that has many different avenues. Did you want to mention a couple others before we continue with some other questions?
Yeah, you would ask me about things that were exciting. I think there's a focus also on environmental factors.
Yes.
My laboratory has been interested in cerebrovascular dysfunction, that is dysfunction in the blood vessels in the brain as they occur with aging, but in particular with the accumulation of this Alzheimer's pathology that we see in the brain. And my lab has been very focused on how hypertension, which is something that's prominent in our culture and many other cultures, and
increasingly
this hypertension affects the vessel function, but it also appears to accelerate the Alzheimer's, that the senile plaque pathology and that tau pathology that I was mentioning, and there's also evidence out there from following large groups of people that adhering to the hypertension therapies, those therapies that lower blood pressure, may have a benefit and long-term benefit in retarding the onset and progression of dementia. I think that the future is bright if we can get enough research money. We're in the process of applying for a grant from NIH to go forward in the development of one of the vaccines that we've been working on for a number of years. And the idea with immunotherapy is that you produce antibody molecules, and I'm going to back up just one second.
Okay.
People in a lay audience would be familiar, if you get bit by a snake, that the snake, poisonous snake, will have venom and it'll have toxins in that venom. And one of the things that you can do to protect yourself is get an injection of anti-venom if you can intervene early enough. So you can think of immunotherapy as sort of using the individual's own immune system to produce something to protect against the accumulation of the beta amyloid peptide in the brain in these senile plaques that accumulate.
Which would be easier on the liver than some of the prescriptions available now to.
Yeah, that's one of the issues. There's many issues with developing effective therapy for neurodegenerative diseases. The brain is protected by what's called the blood-brain barrier, and so the brain is along with the blood-brain barrier, which is part of the cerebrovascular system, defines and determines what gets into the brain and what gets out of the brain. So oftentimes, to get enough, you need typically a small molecule drug. Needs to be small, low in molecular weight. It needs to be, I'm going to say lipophilic, but it needs to be not water soluble. It needs to be able to get across that blood-brain barrier and get into the brain
and be
without causing toxicity to the liver or other organs in the body. So it's a tall order to develop drugs that get into the brain and specifically hit the target that you're aiming at.
So, another the holy grail there.
Yes. So the immunotherapy, the idea is that we develop antibodies by making a vaccine, and that these antibodies will actually bind to this beta amyloid peptide and enhance the clearance of the beta amyloid peptide. And we've done those experiments in my laboratory and a number of laboratories around the world, where we can show in transgenic mouse models of Alzheimer's disease, if we give them immunotherapy, we can clear the plaques. And there's also evidence now from clinical trials in humans that this actually works. The unfortunate thing is, with these clinical trials that have gone forth so far, they typically have been done in very late patients, and we think that it's probably you can reduce the amyloid, but we think it's probably too late in the disease process to see therapeutic benefits. So future clinical trials in the next year or two are going to be done in patients with dominant mutations. And actually, who is it? It's
well, these are the ones that these are patients now in the United States.
Yeah, the, okay. There's patients in the United States. This is the DIAN group. It's the Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer's Network.
Okay.
And the second speaker on Friday's session is going to be Dr. John Morris from Washington University. And the NIH and the Alzheimer's Association are going forward with clinical trials in patients with that have these dominant mutations. That is, they typically develop Alzheimer's disease in their late 20s, 30s, and 40s. So it's a very accelerated disease process.
Right.
And by genetic testing, the researchers are able to determine who's going to get Alzheimer's disease. So they're going to go in before there's any clinical sign,
right,
and then provide both immunotherapy and a small molecule drug, and try and prevent the onset of the dementia by going in early. And that's the hope of the future for people that develop, the vast majority of people that develop Alzheimer's disease. They would be called sporadic Alzheimer's disease.
Well, for those of you who've joined us, my guest in this half of the hour is Professor David Cribbs, professor of neurology at UCI's Medical School. He's talking about his Alzheimer's research, about which he'll be speaking this Friday in Costa Mesa, the 24th annual conference. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and streaming live on all the waiting rooms of clinical trials around the world at KUCI.org. Well, we need to wrap it up so you can get to your meeting and we can complete the giving the details for the conference, but I guess we just want to check in that you'll be around the whole time to, as I said at the there your own research is making its way along from the transgenic mice into humans at some point. How far along, just to wrap up the interview, do you see that your research may have a role in patient treatment?
So right now, as I mentioned, we're applying for a U01 grant,
right,
and that grant would, by the fourth year of that grant, we would be applying for FDA approval of our vaccine. We've already tested in mice, rabbits, and non-human primate monkeys, and we know that the vaccine works in terms of both being able to reduce amyloid plaque load or CNL plaque load in the brain, and we know we can, using this very advanced vaccine design, that we even in monkeys we can get enough antibody production that against this peptide that we should be able to have a therapeutic benefit in patients. So we're very optimistic within 5 or 6 years that we'll be in the clinic.
Well, this is really, really wonderful news. I've gone to many of these conferences, and I can see that there's a sort of a momentum here in looking into more benign treatments, earlier treatments, so that this dreaded disease can be managed in a much, much more effective way. And for those of you who haven't been in close contact with that disease, you may develop an appreciation with a loved one who may be contracting or developing the disease. So, Dr. David Cribbs, I really appreciate your being on the show, and I look forward to meeting you on Friday at the conference.
I hope that people that have been listening to this interview will take the time to consider coming on Friday, and like I said, breakfast and lunch included, and there's also a lot of displays set up that are interesting to look at as well and informative. So
Okay, and I'll cover all that. Thank you so much, and on to your meeting, and I'll see you on Friday.
Right. Bye-bye,
thanks,
Claudia.
Bye-bye. Well, we're going to just go over some of the details. The location for the 24th Annual Southern California Alzheimer's Disease Conference Countdown to 2025, Progress on Ending Alzheimer's Disease, is held this Friday, September 21st, at the Hilton Orange County. That's at 3050 Bristol Street in Costa Mesa. As we were both talking, there is space remaining for anyone still wishing to register. I know I've checked yesterday. And to register, you can call 1-800-272-3900 or go online to act.alz.org/24th. And one word with uppercase A for annual research, R research, C conference. So it's the act.al.org/24th annual research conference. And there you'll get more details about the timing and location and all the panels. It includes Dr. Ron Peterson from the Mayo Clinic, who I believe was Ronald Reagan's physician as Ronald Reagan's Alzheimer's progressed. So now I've got a few announcements before I turn this all over to Jorge Rosales. First announcement is, I'm going to find this again, is Latin Americans is a six-hour, three-part series, premieres tonight on your local PBS channel, and will continue September 24th and October 1st. Our very own humanities professor and Latino-Latina studies chair, Vicky Ruiz, was consulted in the production and is one of the many cameos of scholars and media personalities who appear on the screen to weigh in on little-known Latino history in our very realm. And then on Saturday, September 21st, at the Irvine Congregational Church, they'll be presenting Sister Simone Campbell in the thick of many social causes. She's the executive director, Network, a national Catholic social justice lobby and organizer of the Nuns on a Bus movement. That's Saturday from 1 till 4 at the Irvine Congregational Church at 4915 Alton Parkway in Irvine. And more information is available by calling 949-733-0220. And I couldn't resist one more little tidbit announcement. On Sunday, the BC Space Gallery, and we've had Mark Chamberlain, the owner of the BC Gallery, on about a half a year ago, and he'll be presenting a very special exhibit to open on Sunday, September 22nd, from 4 to 8 p.m., commemorating the life, work of Paul Darrow. He's still around. He'll be there. He's a painter, assemblage artist, photographer, and cartoonist. BC Space is located behind the steel door at 235 Forest Avenue in downtown Laguna Beach. And I'm giving you one more phone number to call, 949-697-5237. Well, that's all the time we have today on Ask a Leader. Next week, we'll hear from Paul Leonard, the California director with the Center for Responsible Lending. And then returning to the show will be Julie Fisher, our go-to scholar on NGOs' role in forming democracies. We'll be talking exclusively about Syria, of course, because we didn't even get to talk about Syria last time. It was about the case studies in her book. But Syria is opened up, and there have been many more proposals toward dismantling the conflict there that will be great to take up with Julia next. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everybody.
No complaints and no regrets. I still believe in chasing dreams and placing bets. But I have learned that all you give is all you get. So give it all.